From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Welcome back to a Cool Science Radio special program on Apollo 11 and the 50th anniversary of landing on the moon. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning is Charlie Precourt, who had a distinguished 15-year career with NASA and is a veteran of four space flights, including two as mission commander. And he logged more than 932 hours in space during that time. Precourt was also deputy program manager for the International Space Station, chief of the astronaut corps, and director of operations for NASA and the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center in Star City, Russia. He's currently the vice president and general manager of the Propulsion Systems Division for Northrop Grumman's Flight Systems Group, where they design and build very large and very powerful rockets. Charlie Precourt, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks, John. Great to be with you this morning. Well, appreciate that introduction.
Oh, well, it's great to have you back. And I wanted to ask you first, where were you and how old were you when you first watched Neil and Buzz walk on the moon 50 years ago?
Yeah, I had just turned 14, and I was with my folks. I lived in Massachusetts growing up, a little town about an hour west of Boston. Mm-hmm. And I was already introduced to aviation and space because my dad flew light airplanes, and my uncle was in the Air Force. And it just was very intriguing to me, and I was right there on the couch at home and watching the whole thing that whole day. First the landing, and then the extravehicular activity, as we like to call it, or the moonwalk, when Neil stepped on the surface.
Exactly. And how did the Apollo program inspire you and inform your career decisions?
Very significantly, as it did for a lot of folks of my age. Our generation was largely impacted by that. There was a resurgence in folks pursuing careers in science and math and so forth. As I mentioned, with my dad and my uncle and their influence and the program's influence, I immediately thought I ought to pursue a career in aviation and wanted to go to the Air Force Academy at my uncle's advice. So I think the program was instrumental in shaping where I would pursue my career aspirations. But as I shared my goals with others of my age, it was pretty common in those times, from the late 60s through the 70s and 80s, that people really appreciated the Apollo program, the fact the nation was reaching out, doing things that hadn't been done before, and that it was exciting to have the opportunity to be a part of that. So.
It's funny, as you say that, Charlie, it makes me think about at that point, in the 60s, all little boys wanted to be firemen or astronauts. And I wonder how true that is today. And of course, having young girls enter into the conversation, how many young girls now are saying, I want to be an astronaut when I grow up? And you probably hear these stories because you're still very involved in aviation.
That's very true. As a matter of fact, when I go speak at schools, especially I think the most formative years are junior high school students that are they've been taught enough through the first 6 years in school to be able to appreciate what it is. And then in the seventh, eighth, ninth grade, they're starting to think about their own opportunity a little more. And so when I speak to kids in junior high school in particular, there's a lot of excitement about becoming astronauts or being involved in the space program. I still get a lot of even younger career workers here at the plant that ask me about what the pathway might be for them to join NASA at some point. Mm-hmm. So it very much, whether it's the celebration of Apollo 50th or whether it's the things we're doing with Space Station and the administration's refocusing us on getting back to the moon, there's a lot of interest. And I think that's really, really exciting because the program really inspires careers, but moreover, those careers inspire tremendous advances for our well-being. It does. The program does touch everything from national security to the creativity of advanced technologies and how those things improve our lives. What we do in space touches all realms of our lives on Earth. And so it's an important program, and I like anything that gets it in the public eye more directly.
Yes, well, it's been important for you your whole life, you know, probably even before that 14-year-old was sitting in front of the TV in 1969. But I'm wondering, you know, as we approach the Apollo 11's 50th anniversary, I think, you know, we're hearing radio shows about it and seeing, you know, on PBS, Chasing the Moon series about it. And it really reminds us and kind of sort of reteaches us the importance of space exploration in a way that I think a lot of people haven't thought about for a long time. And it coincides perfectly, really, with our talk of renewing our missions to the moon, as at the same time that countries like China and even Israel, I was reading the other day, is has a moon mission charted. So how important do you think it is doing this survey, going back, looking at it in terms of reinvigorating the conversation?
Well, you're right. The coincidence of what we're trying to do today to advance NASA's exploration mission has a great uplifting support in the celebration of the Apollo 50th, because it does offer an opportunity to reflect on how well we did then and what we've done in the interim and what that opportunity is in the future. For me, The progression from Mercury to Gemini to Apollo to space shuttle to space station and now into exploration with SLS and Orion and getting back to the surface of the moon, those were all very deliberate steps that NASA has taken. Sometimes they're decades-long endeavors, and because of that, the public gets a little detached from the progress. But when you have a 50th anniversary to support connection from what we've done in the past to where we're going in the future, it really helps. And I think it inspires thinking about it in ways that we did that then. Where are the limits today? So much further out, right? So we're going back to the moon to stay. And I like to talk about it as an analog fashion. It's like we do with the South Pole. We have a McMurdo station on the surface of the South Pole. We send people there on extended journeys to explore the South Pole for a number of reasons. What we can do on the moon in the future is very similar to that, and what we will learn from that is boundless. And we know how much our touch and go on the surface of the moon during the six missions that Apollo flew brought countless enhancements to our economy and our technology and our way of life. And so being in space and continuing to push the boundaries is very, very important. It also is one where we get reminded that it is part of our national security. The Chinese, you mentioned the Israelis, the Russians, others, even the Indians are pushing their own program, many of whom want to be on the same stage as the leaders of the world, us. And we can't forget that being the leader requires us to lead in a lot of domains, and if we don't lead in space, it will be very much visible. And so it is something that is our destiny. It's inspiring. It's a natural thing for Americans to think about from a cultural standpoint, but it's also very important that we stay out there on the forefront.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Charlie Precourt, who had a distinguished 15-year career with NASA and is a veteran of four space flights, including two as mission commander. He's logged more than 932 hours in space. Charlie, you and I were together a couple of months ago at the Park City Film Series when they were screening Apollo 11, and we had a chance to talk about a number of things. And one of the items was just fascinating to me, and I just wanted to bring it up to you. As a fighter pilot for NATO forces, you were close enough to a Soviet MiG fighter to see the pilot's face and while you were on a mission. Tell us about that exercise and how the relationship would eventually unfold between you and this MiG pilot.
Yeah, thanks for introducing that. It was probably one of the more significant phases of my career because, as you mentioned, I was a product of the Cold War, being born in the 50s and being post-World War II when the Soviet Union formed, and we were on opposite sides of what became known as the Iron Curtain. By the time I was in my early 20s and flying F-15s and assigned to West Germany at the time, Germany was divided, my role was to protect the skies from a potential invasion from the East. East Germany was a part of the Soviet Union, now Russia. There was a standoff, if you will, and frequently we would find ourselves flying to the borders of the East and wagging wings with a MiG fighter or other Soviet aircraft that had approached the border. And it became stunning to me that when you look across the sky at the border and see a pilot in the cockpit, because we were very close, and you can't but wonder, what is that person's life like? What are their aspirations? What's their family life like? What makes them tick? And not having a connection because of the Cold War and the Iron Curtain, have that all and study them as your enemy, but never fire a shot in anger because it was a standoff type of war, the Cold War. But then to suddenly, when Reagan declared to Gorbachev, tear down the wall, and it actually happened, and Germany was united, and the presidents who followed Reagan, both Bush Sr. and Clinton, pushed for collaboration with the Russians and used space collaboration as a focus. Suddenly, I found myself at NASA, not 5 years later, training to fly space shuttles and discovering that we were going to have a collaborative program with the Russians. And lo and behold, my first trip to Moscow, I'm introduced to a cosmonaut who I would be training with, who was flying those MiGs in East Germany the same time I was in West Germany. And we very likely could have met for the first time in the air. And then to be invited into his home to have dinner with his family and to discover the answers to those questions I'd had earlier about what is his life like, who is he, what are his aspirations, and and his name was Vasily Tsubliev, and he became the chief cosmonaut at the same time I was chief astronaut. We worked together to select astronaut crews. We also flew together. He was the commander of the Mir on my second mission to the Mir, of my three trips to the Mir. And just a tremendous turnaround in our lives, because suddenly those who had been our enemies were now our partners, and just a tremendous thing to be a part of.
Yeah, that's a great story. And another takeaway from that evening at the Park City Film Series, watching Apollo 11, was when they finally landed, because it was precarious as they were running out of fuel and they had overshot their intended landing spot. I turned to you and I said, 50 years later, and this thing still blows my mind. And you look at me and you said, mine too. I mean, we were like a couple of, we were like a couple of kids. It's just incredible that you can go back and still have that reaction. I was 17 years old in Acton, Massachusetts, which is also west, northwest of Boston. And with my father and my mother and one of my brothers watching the whole thing unfold. And it was just, it was just fascinating, wasn't it?
There's so many pieces of it that you have to marvel at. It was a first, and it was a giant leap in terms of achievement. We had gone so far in such a short period of time, but when you think of the people that made it happen, most of the engineers and the pilots were in their 20s and 30s. Most of the people who worked in the control center were in their 20s, very young, stepping out to do something that had never been done before. The the folks that are in industry and aerospace today are more senior to that. Our demographic is much older, and many of us would have a hard time thinking that the new recruits we get fresh out of college or in their 20s would be able to deal with technical problems like that, let alone pull off a moon landing. But you know, they had alarms going off in the cockpit of the lander, the Eagle, and three times, I think it was, the control center said, you're still go. A guy by the name of Jack Garman at Johnson Space Center had figured out all those codes that were being displayed during the alarms on the descent. And Jack later became the head of the information technologies, the computer software IT department at the Johnson Space Center during my time at the shuttle program. And so I got to work with him after that. But most people probably wouldn't recognize that someone like him in his 20s was at the console in the control center making the call to say, yeah, Neil, you're still go to the surface, when it could have been an abort. I mean, there's so many things like that behind the scenes that had to go right, and they pulled it off. It's pretty incredible.
And Charlie, Margaret Hamilton, who wrote most of the code, was the one that put the 1201 and the 1202 error sequence in there, which basically said, I'm overloaded right now. I'm going to get rid of secondary tasks, and I'm going to focus on primary tasks. So it was a combination of Margaret and so many. I mean, it was just, as you said, it was just incredible how the whole thing came together.
Yep, it really was. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were doing it because we were in a race with the Soviet Union. There was a, you know, it was a pretty much a bipolar universe for those of us on Earth, with two superpowers, not a number of countries like there are today that were vying for their spots in the pecking order. And you know, we were really fighting for our way of life by being able to beat the Soviets to the surface of the moon. And we had stepped out quite briskly towards the end. And the day that we landed, they were only able to muster putting an unmanned probe on the backside of the moon, basically crash landed it on the backside of the moon the same day that Neil and Buzz landed. So it's just an incredible set of events in a short period of time.
The race to the moon, it makes me think about the things that I've heard astronaut Frank Borman talk about in his mission, which was it Apollo 8, I believe?
Yeah.
Where he said, for me, it wasn't about going to the moon. It was about beating the Russians. That was it.
Yeah.
You know, it was about this extreme patriotism.
Yeah.
And that makes me think about families. And Frank Borman talks so much about his family and how he was so focused on getting home to his family. And I know there's been a lot of focus on the families, the wives with Astronauts Wives Club and stories about what the families had to endure. And it makes me curious about your own family. You have three kids, I believe. And when you were on your four separate missions, how did your family, your wife and your kids, endure that? And what does it make you feel like when you hear all of these stories brought to life, whether in books or movies or what have you, about the Apollo 11 mission?
Well, there's no doubt that the challenge for the families in those earlier days was greater, because when I flew, there had been a lot of learning. And so the support structure improved for the families. And so, on the one hand, it was in some ways easier for our families than it was for theirs. On the other, it was nevertheless a very still, risky undertaking. The odds of returning on a shuttle mission were worse than 1 in 200. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about the odds of not getting home in your car or not landing in an airliner when you get on an airline. If you fly an airliner today, your odds of not coming back are less than 1 in 10 million. You're going to have to fly that many times before there's a real problem, just because the safety of the system has become so good. But a space shuttle flight was 1 in 200 that you might not come home. So that stark reality was something the families had to deal with, and You know, in my tenure when I was chief astronaut, we lost the Columbia crew. So it was in many ways more difficult on the families than on the crew, because they had that worry. And we had a tremendously strong support structure. Colleague astronauts who were not flying would be at the very side of our families. They were kept from the public, protected and well taken care of. So, yet nevertheless, all of us and our families included recognized that we were volunteering to do something that we believed in passionately and we believed was making contributions to our society that were really necessary, and that we sought the reward of the opportunity. And so it was a really strong, well-knit community of crews and families that went through this together. Frank speaks about it very well. And the tradition lives on today with the way we support crews when they fly in space, because the risks still are there, and they are significant.
Mm. You know, today we're celebrating Apollo 11, the successful mission, and as you've mentioned, that the risks are there and the disasters have happened. And I want to ask you this. It's jumping off on a little bit different tangent, but I think there's so many people in Utah who are unfamiliar with the work of Northrop Grumman, whether it's at your facility in the Salt Lake Valley or in, you know, out in, oh gosh, wherever it is out in the West Desert, yeah, is how we usually refer to it. But mm-hmm. the evolution of, you know, Morton Thiokol to ATK to the Northrop Grumman, and the role of Morton Thiokol with the Challenger and its foreshadowing of the disaster with the freezing of the O-rings. Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting story because a lot of Utahns don't know, a lot of people don't know that story. Can you just briefly take us
sure.
through that?
Yeah, so we, as you point out, that facility is out in Promontory, Utah, about 20 minutes west of Brigham City. And it's a very sizable facility that was stood up in the 50s to support the development of the Minuteman nuclear missile fleet. And there's a sister facility in Magna, Utah, on the west side of Salt Lake that was known as Hercules in its day. And the two facilities became the world's leaders in solid rocket motor technology. The shuttle motors were built up at Promontory beginning in the late 70s. These two facilities come under Northrop Grumman today under my leadership as the general manager. And through a series of business dealings and acquisitions, they went from Morton Thiokol to Thiokol to Thiokol and Hercules coming together under ATK, and then Orbital Sciences and ATK merging to become Orbital ATK, and then Northrop buying Orbital ATK. So that's just the string of things that happened from a business standpoint. But to your point about the space shuttle and the Challenger accident, the shuttle boosters were built at Thiokol at the time up in Promontory, Utah. Today, a derivative of that booster is being built by the same workforce in the same facility, a much advanced version for the Space Launch System, which will be a very heavy, bigger than the Saturn V, to take us back to the moon and on to Mars. And so we have a very proud workforce to be engaged in this. But what happened in the day was there was a very, very sharp cold spell down at the Kennedy Space Center in early 1986, and against the recommendation of engineers, NASA elected to continue with a launch count when, in fact, they probably should have delayed, because the O-rings did not seat because they become frozen in those temperatures. And, you know, the story of the loss of the Challenger crew is one that many people are aware of. And it taught us a very harsh lesson. There were design changes made after the accident. The engineers out here took it very hard and very personal, obviously, and devoted themselves to never having something like that happen again. And they become producers of some of the most reliable, energetic rocket motor technologies the world's ever seen. And they did things like put heaters around the bands of the a rocket motor where the O-rings were. But they also redesigned the joints so that leaks like that that occurred due to the O-rings freezing would not be possible. And so this motivation of continuous improvement and a workforce that was dedicated to ensuring that we didn't lose astronauts is a culture that has lived to this day. I'm very proud of these folks, having flown the shuttle four times and the boosters post that accident and the improvements. I have the utmost confidence in them, and their dedication is stunning. And it's just been a great opportunity for me to be a part of the business here with them. Very, very dedicated and contributing immensely to the future of our national security with systems like the Trident nuclear submarine missiles, the future next generation of Minuteman missiles, the missile defense missiles, the rockets that launch our spy satellites, and the future of NASA. A lot of that being built right here, and Utahns should be proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had the good fortune of being invited out for a solid fuel booster test when I first met you, Charlie. I interviewed you.
Yeah.
And it was just extraordinary. How's that program going? Because that's a booster that can be, I believe it's the largest solid fuel booster that's ever been designed or built, and that can be configured in so many different ways.
Yes, absolutely. And because of the size of the booster, it's difficult to get it transported to a launch site from the manufacturing site without making it in segments. So the space shuttle booster was four segments, and they were assembled in the big, giant vertical assembly building at Kennedy on the launch platform for the space shuttle. The new booster for the Space Launch System for Moon and Mars, which, as I mentioned, will be bigger than Apollo, is five segments, so it's a stretch version, that much more powerful. Each of those produces nearly 4 million pounds of thrust, so two of them, you can imagine the immense power that's going to lift to get off the planet and go to Moon and Mars. The fact that they're made in segments has offered us the opportunity to morph them into other configurations, so not only for the Space Launch System, but for the Air Force's future generation of satellite launchers for national security, we are in a competition with a new rocket that we call our Omega rocket system to be able to lift the Air Force's satellite requirements to all of its known necessary orbits. And that vehicle will use a two-segment at the base core of the rocket and a single segment as a middle stage and a liquid engine upper stage, and we're really excited about that opportunity to derive something from existing NASA technologies that can be used in national security and to be able to make that offering to the Air Force. So that's what we're engaged in here today, is programs like that for both national security and for NASA.
Charlie, we want to thank you so much for joining us on our special 50th anniversary program. When we first started designing this particular show, you were the person, the one person that we absolutely wanted to have on the program. So thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Really appreciate it. And enjoy the 50th.
Okay. And continued success at Northrop Grumman.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.